Hi, my name is Troy Asanoff, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. My guest this week, Troy Asanoff, co-founder of Juice and Peachy, general partner of Magic Fund, Penguin Alpha, and former head of acquisitions at BuzzFeed. First question off the bat, I was going to talk to you about your first business card, which is hilarious, and I would recommend everyone go check that out. It's your pinned tweet at the moment, being Jan 2022, so we'll see. But I was going to ask, why don't you show your bag? What have you got going on in Web3 at the moment?
Way too many NFTs, hundreds at this point. Got addicted. My buddy Farouk told me early last year to buy them. I kept saying it's silly. Why would I pay? Want to pay $1,000 for a few pixels? I got the same negativity that everyone had about the space. I love crypto. I've been in the space for a while, and then finally I was just like, you know what? Let's try it. Why not? And then of course the space blew up, and I love the community in the space, how welcoming it is, like camaraderie and the enthusiasm and momentum on the space. So I started dabbling more and more and expanding my horizons with Web3. So went to NFTs, bought way too many, traded a bunch. And then I started getting more into the DeFi side of things with staking, lending, and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, right.
So putting my coins to work.
Yeah. So I feel like that's NFTs have, like, for a lot of people, have been a gateway drug to DeFi in the last year.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you in on DeFi? Are you big on sort of like the OHM protocols, or are you more like a Frog Nation kind of guy?
I mean, yeah, like a few months ago, I was just like, you know, I'm going to go all in full DeGen and just see what happens. So I went like OHM, Time, Klima, SquidDAO, Strong Nodes, like you name it. I was just throwing things in to see what would happen. Thankfully, a lot of them worked out. A lot of them, like SquidDAO, not so much. It's funny because also everyone's like, it's a rug Squid Game. It's from Squid Game. I'm like, no, it's completely different. This one's okay. And then, of course, it's now thing too. But yeah, I just want to get exposure. Like for me, like if I want to explore space, I need to actually feel it. I want to put like my money behind it and actually experience what it's like from a user perspective, but also experience what it's like, what the returns can be potentially like, and how the space is. And the current state of DeFi is a bit of a mess. It's very complicated. It's a little over the top. But the returns are definitely there. So definitely, thankfully, have been making money within DeFi, but Lordy, is it a mess? It's a lot.
Yeah. Look, my dad isn't going to pick up DeFi anytime soon. that's for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm a little bit of a stealth project, but we actually fundraised for a project in the DeFi space, me and my co-founders. So we're actually addressing that head on. And that's actually what I say a lot of time is that, you know, there's no shot that my parents are going to be actually to be able to set up a MetaMask and deal with like a DeFi staking, all that. But make something super simple because the opportunity for more people to get into the ecosystem and get these returns. So something that's being built now and should be released in the next month to 2 months.
Okay. That's very interesting. I'm like you, I went full degen into like Butterfly and OHM have been big ones.
Butterfly too, yeah.
Yeah.
Butterfly's a good one though.
Butterfly is fascinating. And it really taught me about the whole curve wars and like gauge bribes and all that. It's just a good way to learn more than anything. The biggest insight for me was not so much these APYs and these returns you can get, but actually what it's done for how businesses or systems are going to be built. Like I did notice in particular with things like NFTs, or any of these DeFi protocols, how like no one's employed. It's just a bunch of people. It's a true meritocracy. If you don't do the work, if you don't put in, if it doesn't perform, like you're cut, you know, it's just.
That's the whole theme behind like crypto in general.
Yeah. Being,
like with the original like mining, like when you're originally mining and then now like with the staking, like it's always you get in what you put out, like you get out what you put in basically.
Yeah. Well, look, I work for the biggest, centralized exchange here in Australia. And that was the big thing for me because I was like, holy shit, these DEXs, all these sort of swapping based systems. I just don't know how I can see how centralized exchanges will still exist. There's no doubt, because they make things simple. But what happens when decentralized exchanges are able to do that for people? I don't know how those sort of organizations survive in comparison to a DEX. So that was the big thing for me is like just the new way of working, so to speak. It was a real eye-opener.
For sure.
Let's jump back to your childhood. What's like your earliest memory in life?
In life? One of my very, I guess, very random. Nothing to do with work, but like one of my earliest memories was actually one of my first words.
Okay.
I just remember my first words were actually bad boy. And I remember specifically just saying it over and over again, which was interesting first words to pick. I don't think I'm a bad guy. But definitely distinct there. But and then like related to work, like I just remember being glued to the computer as soon as I saw it when I was a kid. And like I'm 33 now, so being glued to the computer didn't mean having like, you know, MySpace or Facebook or even AOL. It was like on my dad showed me this thing called Prodigy, which like I was super young. I didn't know what it was. I just were clicking around on the internet, being fascinated by it. And I remember, like, I just was always wanting to spend every waking minute on the computer when I was a kid. Like, I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. Like, even before, like, the internet side, like, literally just, like, playing around, like, just being, like, this digital thing in front of me that I can move a mouse and, like, things happen in front of me. And then the more and more I learned about it, the more, in, like, infatuated I got with it.
Interesting. And what did your dad do that made him introduce something like Prodigy? Was he just a hobbyist himself, or did he work as an engineer or something like that?
No, I mean, both my parents barely know how to use a computer still to this day. My dad a little more so than my mom. But I don't know the reason he had to show it to me, but I think they realized pretty quickly that I was just hooked on it. And yeah, I remember just like I was fascinated by everything, like to a weird degree, to the point like I remember I saw a cruise giveaway like ad on the internet when I was like super young, literally pre-AOL. And I remember literally just calling the phone number there and like, why are you giving me a cruise? Like, what are you doing here? Like, and just asking questions about everything. Like, that's the kind of kid I was. I was just fascinated by it. My parents never did anything with technology. Never pushed me toward that direction. Never pushed me away from it. They just kind of like let me explore what I was interested in. And I just kept going down that rabbit hole. And that's like when the business card comes in. Like I was, you know, 9 years old. I was always trying to like quote unquote entrepreneurial when I was a kid. I was always just trying to find ways to like make money. Like, so I used to go door to door washing cars. And like, that was the most obvious thing to me at the time was like, if I wash a car, I get $10. I wash, you know, a few cars, I can buy some Pokemon cards. And then I found this site called Angel Fire and I started poking around that. I'm like, oh, I can actually make like my own website myself. That's really cool. And like I started just right-clicking, viewing. And so my friend told me, it's like, hey, do you know if you right-click and view source, you can see the code of a website. I'm like, what's code? And I like viewed source and dug down that. So I used to like copy like Microsoft.com or whatever like obvious website, like and just put into my Angel Fire. And then I just added the code around to see what would happen. And like that's how I learned to taught myself how to code, just messing around, like pulling from big websites and messing around and just seeing what happened. Then pull it like Googling different code scripts. Yeah, and then I realized like, hey, like, all these businesses in my neighborhood don't have websites. Like they could all use their own website and I could make an Angel Fire for free. And I could charge them $50 a pop for a website. Instead of spending hours washing cars outside in the heat, I could be inside where it's air conditioned and make websites for these people. And it takes me, you know, a few hours and actually enjoy doing it. So that's like where that card kind of came from.
What did your parents do?
My mom was in fashion, like a buyer. And my dad was in the nursing home business.
Right, okay. And they worked in those businesses or they ran their own businesses?
My dad ran his own business.
Okay. Yeah, so that's probably where it came from, like the intrigue into entrepreneurship and doing your own thing.
I can see that for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't like even aware like that you could do that or not. I feel like at that age, I feel like it was just, I don't know. I feel like a lot of it, and I say this like in tweets and stuff, that a lot of and I feel like it happens for a lot of people like my age and like millennial in general, is that a lot of the entrepreneurial spirit actually I think more so than like definitely my parents have an influence seeing that from my dad, but more so the video that the games we played as a kid. Like I tweet, like obviously it's later in life, but there's a game called like RuneScape that a lot of people that I know I currently played growing up. And a lot of like RuneScape and these games taught a lot of like fundamental things like for potentially aspiring entrepreneurs, like bartering and trading, how to do negotiations, like how to like, if you like putting it like drilling in the concept, like if you put in the work, you actually get good at something. Like a lot of like it's silly, but like I truly think like I learned how to negotiate and trade and all this, like, and barter all that just by like trading in RuneScape and like these different games.
Yeah, RuneScape was a, I remember my brother and I played RuneScape, and it was some sort of Lego game where you had to like build worlds. It was sort of like early iterations of things like Minecraft, I feel. RuneScape, though, I didn't get as deep into it as my brother did. He played that game so much, man. Like, he must have been playing that for 4 or 5 hours a day, easy.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I was like, when I was, if I had time to kill, like at school, like I just go to the library and play RuneScape.
Yeah, play RuneScape. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think like that was also a big inspiration, not only to myself, but a lot of people like the same generation as me. It's just these games growing up taught a lot of like, unintentionally taught a lot of foundational entrepreneurial skills.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's funny how they do that in hindsight. Or like, you look back in hindsight and go, wow, I learned this from a fucking game.
Yeah.
What?
I mean, it definitely was not the intention, but it was cool how it came out. And yeah, it's like, it's funny, like a lot of the entrepreneurs I'm friendly with to this day, they all played like RuneScape, World of Warcraft, or like some kind of like game of that caliber growing up.
Mm. I want to touch on you and your study. So straight out of the gate, I think high school, uni, you're into a company called Pando Networks. It looks like a peer-to-peer distribution company. I could be wrong, but from an outsider's perspective, it looks like that. Now hearing your story, learning to code and all that sort of stuff, it makes sense that you would go into this area, right? So you're in a high-growth area in 2008. So that was, to me, like quite a seminal time for the tech industry. So many businesses were built off then. All the big, what we call Web 2 now, or these big monolithic companies like Facebook, Uber, et cetera, they were built around that time at the depths of the recession. So 2008, you'd already invested in companies via Spark Ventures. 2011, you co-founded a company called, was it KetUp? KetUp?
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
So how early did you realize that you were best suited for fast-paced founding tech media businesses?
I mean, I learned pretty quickly because I love just building things. And that's when I made that site, like making a gift for that time as well. Like I had always have a habit of like, I still do this to this day where like if I hit a roadmap, I wrote roadblock, whether like for that, like I couldn't make gifts. Like I just didn't know how. I didn't know how to use any of the Adobe products. I randomly got really good at using MS Paint, like zoom in at 800% and edit pixel by pixel because I couldn't understand how to use Adobe. I don't know what it was. So I figured I couldn't be the only person with this issue that like did not make GIFs and decided to make a GIF to make it just an easy way to make great GIFs and combine them with the vision of GIFs. So I, like to this day, I still like, if I have a roadblock that I hit, I write it down. I try to see if there's any viable businesses around that. Just like, okay. It's just a habit I've always done. Yeah. So I always like building things. And so like for that kind of stuff, like KetUp, for example, it was, as once with a friend of mine, we're putting together, I think we were just a little too early, but we were basically doing like Let Go a little bit, like a few years before that. We noticed like the iPhone, like the camera, like smartphone cameras, you know, they were getting good enough to take photos. We actually see them look like potato quality. So let's start, like there's an opportunity to easily take pictures, upload things to our site or our app and buy from there. Like this Craigslist is an awful way to organize. So basically we made like an early iteration of Let Go a few years before they did, but again, we were just a little too early. But like that's just a constant, like that was a problem I had. Like I was trying to buy something or list something on Craigslist. Or just this is a terrible way to do this. It's a terrible way to buy and sell. So we're like, let's make a business around this. So okay. I don't know if it's always the fast pace. I don't know if it's like here or there for me. Like I think it's nice that things move fast because I like moving fast. But I think just the idea of creation and building things and solving problems really excites me.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got this innate creativity, this like openness and awareness. So you're able to do that. Like you said, you find roadblocks, No doubt you probably got some sort of like Evernote list or like some sort of notes where you're just writing down shit like that all the time, because I do things like that. And then
I do the worst. I just text myself.
Do you?
Time I just text myself, which is like, I don't know why. It's like I'm the habit of it years ago.
Yeah.
And like Evernote would be much better. I started getting into Notion, thankfully, for the past year. And like, this is a much better way to organize.
Okay. So Notion's the way to go. And it sounds like when you found a business like Getup, you're learning about the conscientiousness required to work out whether there's not a market fit, but whether the timing is right. Because sometimes there is market fit, but sometimes it's just not big enough. Do you know what I mean?
That was definitely a lesson learned at that time, is that like you could have a great idea, but you could be way too early.
Yeah.
So like everyone always says like first mover advantage, which I don't always think is a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty nice to be a second mover sometimes. Like let the first mover deal with all the headaches and like you learn from their mistakes, which is like a concept most people don't really consider, because it's like, I got to be the first. I have this idea, I got to be first. But like most of the big successes are not the first ones.
I agree with that. And so then let's talk about Juice. So you leave BuzzFeed, working there as head of acquisitions. It's 2017. You founded Juice. Why was the timing right then?
So when I was at BuzzFeed, I knew I wasn't going to be there that long. They wanted to get into e-commerce and consumer-facing like products. I thought it was a good opportunity to go there. I had some friends that were over there, so I was like, all right, we'll see how this is. It was kind of like this temporary holdover just to see what it was like working for a large organization and like this great reputation at the time. Like it was 2016, like BuzzFeed is probably close to its peak. So I wanted to go over there, and I knew I wasn't gonna stay there that long. So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I happened to meet Michael, who's my co-founder for Juice, and him and I were just kind of going back and forth like we want to launch next. We had some ideas like MarTech space and like some consumer apps and stuff that we were debating doing, and we both kept getting just hit up for consulting all the time. And we were like, you know what, we didn't know who to refer people to, because like we never felt like we truly enjoyed our agency experience working with our agencies. And we're like, you know, like as a holdover for now, let's just make an agency and put like and start consulting people together. And we'll just do everything that we hated about, like the opposite of what we hated about agencies, like bad communication, over putting too many heads, like too many clients per head, and like all the and like doing the same thing and expecting different results. Like all the things agencies do, like let's do the opposite.
Okay.
So we came together, like, let's make an out of the box agency, like kind of grow brands the way we grew our own. Like, let's not do the cookie cutter approach. Every brand is different. Every audience is different. Every brand needs to speak differently. Every brand needs a different approach. And the ads don't convert from the ads, they convert on the website. So let's optimize the whole website while we're doing it too. And treat this truly like it's our own business. And when customers and my clients put their business in our hands, we can't take that lightly. You know, that's a livelihood. Like it's not like, let's give it to a junior employee and see what happens. Like, no, that junior employee tanks their business, they're losing their house. Like that's something like agencies really don't consider. So we applied all these like this methodology and tactics and mentality to our clients. And we bootstrapped Juice in like 2017. And I mean, thankfully it's been growing ever since. And you know, in 5,000 last year, 105, over 40 happy employees. It's been great.
14 years in, headcount has grown. It's 14 years, 4 years in. Headcount grown consistently, at least 13% during COVID, as an example. So I think that's sort of a good signal of where the business is at.
We actually doubled during COVID. And Michael and I actually, and David, another partner, we actually made a commitment during COVID, when the pandemic first hit, we saw a lot of agencies doing like mass layoffs. And we said to each other, like, no matter what happens, let's commit to no layoffs. Let's double down. And even if it means that three of us don't take a salary, that's okay, because we're going to reinvest and we believe in the business. We believe in our team. Thankfully, we didn't have to do a single layoff, and we doubled like in size out of a year.
That's the beautiful thing about being an independent. I can just see what you mean. Like groups like Publicis, WPP, et cetera, they just have to. Well, I have friends working in that space. WPP here was horrific. I think they laid off 30-40% of their staff locally.
I remember that, yeah. That's what we saw. And we're like, we can't do that.
It's just sad, man. Because the thing is that 6 to 9 months later, they were rehired anyway.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, so it's like,
I mean, no one expected what to happen and happens. Like that
Academy
all of a sudden do amazing. Like, don't expect that.
I just thought, like, why not? I like that approach in Japan. Like, you get a lot of executives, when a business is doing poorly for various reasons, whether it's headwinds, whether it's the industry, whatever it may be, and the executives will take a cut across the board on top of employees. So they always aim to never fire people. Now, that can also be a bad thing, because in Japan, you get a lot of people who just stick around at a company and no real innovation sometimes. But I do like that approach when it comes to, you know, sticking together and pushing through this thing. I'm curious, with Juice, I could ask you about the golden principles for brands, and I'm sure you'd give me some concise approach of some sort. But I'm more curious around, like, where do brands just consistently make mistakes? Like, when they come into you, they chat to you guys, and you go, ah, okay, this is the thing, we know immediately we can add value here. What is that particular area?
It's tough to like lock it into one area. But I will say that I think the biggest issue that brands face is they don't consider on-site optimization at all. Like, they say the problem, like, brands think that the issue is just, you know, it's the wrong ad, it's the wrong creative, which is throwing more money at this problem. But if you're not fixing fundamental root issues of your business, like of your website, like, no matter how much traffic we send, like, it's not going to convert. Mm-hmm. So for us, like, that's something that we consistently, and that's probably the reason a lot of brands come to us, because we're not only looking at the ads themselves that we're running, but we're also looking at, all right, the ads send, like, you know, the goal of an ad is to get someone off of Facebook in the platform. Mission accomplished. Great. But when the client wants a conversion, so when they're on their website, where are the drop-off points? Where are the points of confusion? Why do people not convert? And the people that do, what actually drove them, or what path did they take to actually get there? And that's something that brands aren't really considering. Like, a lot of our clients that we notice, like, we look at the FAQ page a lot. FAQ page is a sales page in itself. People don't really consider it that. So for us, we look at the FAQ page and we see, like, look, if someone actually reads this question, like, where is the product made? Whatever. So whatever the question may be. We notice there's like a 30% uptick in sales after they read that question, know where it's from, or whatever the FAQ is. So we can actually take in like the data we see on site and apply it to the actual advertising in the ads. And actually it would cut that whole need to go to the FAQ page in itself and go directly into a sale and have that increased conversion rate, which of course would lead to a decrease in cost per acquisition. So like the on-site nuance is a thing that brands constantly don't think of.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think when we first started our agency and we were doing social ads, we would do the ads and I would just keep coming back to this issue of, like, you know, we really should be pushing these people to update their website, because whenever we run ads, we always make sure the website is looking fresh as, like, it has to have the most up-to-date information. It just has to be looking amazing so that when the people come in, they convert. There's just no questions asked that they convert. Do you know what I mean? And I think it sort of sounds similar that you've picked up that innately as well. And I'd agree. But it's a hard conversation to have, because sometimes people just think they have a marketing problem and not a conversion rate issue. And when it dawns on them what the issue is, they're like, oh shit, I'm in for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that's like when we're talking to a lot of the brands we're starting with, we kind of just preempt them. Like, a lot of the work we do is on-site, and it's not just the advertising side. This is something that you're willing to commit to with us. Because we want to truly feel like an extension of your team and a partner, not that external agency that's just like, oh, we tried the ads, this didn't work. They didn't work. Let's throw more money at it and see what happens. Like, no, like, the ads didn't work. Let's figure out why they didn't work. Let's dig that deep in with you, like, with you, and figure out what are your restock times? What are your inventory levels? How do we work against that? Like, a real true partner.
Yeah. How early on did you realize it was important to specialize? Like, you could have gone into all angles. You could have, if you're doing this website development in tandem with ads, and I would group you in that sort of growth category of an agency. Why not branch out into all these other areas? What made you go, no, we're just going to do growth and growth only?
I mean, it's just, I wish we could say it was intentional and we had a plan, like it was master plan to do it, but it's like, no, we just stuck to what we knew. To this day, like, even with Juice, we stick to our core competencies. And like, if there's a new platform that came out, like whatever, new social platform, we wouldn't launch into it until we're confident we have a team around it that we can really truly support it. So we just always kind of upright and understick to what, you know, what you're good at, and just double down there. And that's like, that's why we have a great referral network of clients coming in. Like, and that's why we have a good reputation, just because we don't try to go outside of our, like, what we know. And do a deliver a poor service just because it might mean extra ad dollars for now, but it's our reputation's everything to us.
Yeah, I agree with that. What if I told you the way to take your brand to the next level in 2022 is with TikTok ads? A lot of our clients come to us with a problem. They need to take their brand to the next level. They're typically doing 5 to 10K a month, and they need to jump to that 25, 50K per month level. And Instagram and Facebook just isn't what it was. So what's the commonality amongst all this? It is primarily opportunity in a saturated market. And we think that TikTok ads today is the answer. Now, Narelle follows a two-phase process to guide you as a challenger brand on the way to growth. Phase one is all about knowing your brand and niche back to front with a focus on breaking even or getting above a break even. Phase two is scaling that creative to blow up your sales in the process once we've secured you as the leader in that niche on TikTok. You do this with the right partner, a committed partner like Narelle, and you'll build that confidence in an area that has typically been saturated in the past. Is not a silver bullet, and we'd love to chat to you. So book in a consultation with our specialist team. Just go to narelle.com/TikTok. That's NERALLE.com/TikTok, and we'll chat to you from there. When you think about Juice as a business where it is right now, and we're going to get into sort of NFTs, crypto, the metaverse, Web3, all that sort of stuff, there's a clear to me, being involved in a few NFT projects, one from a strategy point of view, but also running a talent / influencer agency, that there is a crossover here of some sort. Now, we spoke about earlier that NFTs for you was just a gateway drug to DeFi, and it was the same for me as well. But there is all of these sort of what you call Web3 agencies popping up. But at the end of the day, I find that Web3 is just a transition of a platform rather than a whole new thing that you need to start an agency around. So have you given any thought to how you would integrate Web3 into Juice and offer that as a service? Or do you think that you always remain in that sort of e-com focus?
No, I mean, we have some clients outside of e-com, like B2B and SaaS clients. So, I mean, but a big portion of our business definitely falls under the D2C e-com side. But I mean, a lot of these like Web3 agencies are just rebranded influencer agencies. Like, they can call themselves a Web3 agency, but they're hiring influencers, all they're doing. Like, yeah. Sorry, but like we do influencers. So I guess we're in a Web3 agency now.
Yeah.
We work with a few crypto companies, thankfully, that have been doing very well. I'm sure is like you and the audience most knows that a lot of the platforms have not been the most friendly to crypto advertising to the point like, I remember like when we first were starting Juice, so we had a client that was doing, it's an accounting firm for crypto. And Facebook just kept banning our ads because it was talking about crypto, but like it was just an accounting firm that happened to specialize. So these platforms take like sweeping bans across when it comes to crypto, CBD, wherever it is. That's why like most of the agencies, like when they say they're Web3 agency, that means that they're generally running influencers. Sometimes they do like Discord marketing, which generally means Discord spam, which we would never do.
So it depends.
But I mean, influencers for sure we're doing actively.
It's so funny you mentioned that because I'm trying to think back. One of the people involved in the project that I've been working on at the moment, he's got he's like yourself. He's done pretty well. You know, he's got a Bored Ape. He's got a Mutant Ape. He's got Doodles, Alien Friends, like a bunch of different projects that have really kicked off. So he understands, I think, the IP and the art related to these projects, but he's never launched his own project. And so we initially launched a project that did okay, but, you know, it didn't do as well as it could have. And it's transformed into sort of Gen 2 of a collection. He was just, we did like a post-mortem on marketing. And it's so funny to see these agencies and like what their packages are. They have these packages of like shill your bag and all. And we went through the stats on the Discord of like these people and like half the time the core team was not chatting to real people, as in like they would get questions from people privately on Discord and answer those questions. But then they would also get questions from the influencers per se that were there to shill the bag, to hype, you know, like communication in the Discord. and they'd be chatting to them about the project one-on-one, and they thought they were a real person, and they never end up, like, they're on the whitelist. They never end up converting on the whitelist. Like, so it was fascinating for me to do a post-mortem with these guys for the Gen 2 project, because so much of what you just said, like, you just realize when you're involved in the project, like, it's just all hot air. You know what I mean? Which is so funny.
Like, influencers marketing can be really tough, because you're dealing with, like, Facebook marketing is great because you're just like getting like money to Facebook, you're telling them what to do, and obviously the system in place puts it there. Influencers, you're dealing with humans. Humans are very difficult, and you give them extra steps in a complicated world like Web3, if, like, especially though influencers aren't familiar with Web3, like, you're setting yourself up for disaster. And like you said, like, you can give them access to the whitelist, like, you can whitelist them for minting, like, probably forget, like, the same way that, like, if you have a traditional influencer, give them a pair of shoes, like, they'll probably forget to post. You got to harass them a few times. But, like, we're on a stricter deadline when it comes to Web3, because you need that momentum, and you want people to see, like, in their wallet. That's because it's more visual. Like, this, like, it adds more complexity to already difficult industry.
Yeah. How did you get into crypto? What was your first sort of little nibble in this space?
Yeah, so I mean, it was actually pretty interesting. In 2011, I was doing some angel investing, and I was looking at some opportunities. I noticed a common trend of some deals that were sent my way that were helping people send money back to their home countries. And at the same time, I saw a few different countries. I remember, like, for example, like, it was like the Cypriot government, I believe, was anything over $500,000 in your bank account, the government just took from you. And I was like, there must be a better way to send money and own your money. And then my friend's like, have you seen Bitcoin? And I was like, mind blown. And that was like my aha moment, that I was like, okay, this is going to be a thing. So I had like full conviction at that time. And I just kept buying. I was used to day trade it like back then, but I just kept buying and holding. And yeah, that was like 2011-ish. And I just was hooked since. And, yeah.
Wow, dude. I remember I was at uni in 2008. And finishing up around 2011. And by 2011, I'd heard about it in this year three sort of, because I did accounting and finance. So we're doing like this market trading. I think it was around derivatives or something like that. And people were talking about Bitcoin. And this guy was telling me about Bitcoin. I'm like, the fuck is this shit?
It's gotta go nowhere.
It's gonna go nowhere. And then I went to Europe for like the classic post uni tour. You know, you go away, you work a bit, all that sort of stuff. It wasn't until 2014 that I finally dipped in, which is like in hindsight.
That's still good. That's still early.
It's still early, but like I really didn't. When you look back at it in hindsight, so many little things. Like I know people who've they lost a wallet that they used to buy a pizza for like 5 Bitcoin. And they're like, and now the wallet had like 15 Bitcoin left on it. And they're just like, oh my God.
I have so many horror stories. My friend's dad needed a computer, and I just decided, like, oh, I have an old iMac, just I'll wipe it and you can have it. I wiped 100 Bitcoin off my computer before.
Oh my gosh.
I spent 5 Bitcoin on a couch from Overstock for like some cheap pleather couch. And like now it's like the world's most expensive couch, I feel like.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I feel like we all made those mistakes. And then, but it's also like,
you gotta learn.
Yeah. I always say to people that, like, oh, so like, I can't believe if I would have bought back then, I wish I would have bought back then. But like, I don't think most people had the conviction to hold back then, because people don't realize like the extremes that crypto went through. Like, I remember being on such a high when like Bitcoin hit $1,200, and I'm like, this is amazing, like to the moon, blah, blah, blah. And then like a few days later, it went down to like 80. And I was like, okay, my life is over.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there's the extreme like cycles that crypto has gone through. I mean, like Bitcoin, like before, like not saying it was low, but like at a few thousand, but like before 2020, like mid 2020, it was at a low for a bit. Since the 2017 like drop, it takes a lot of conviction, and you got to have the stomach for it for sure.
Yeah, there's two bad winters. There was the one prior to the sort of 2017 boom, which was mainly in late 2017. Now in hindsight, I first got into working in the space in sort of like 2017, early 2018. So I experienced the second crypto winter, which was definitely not as long as the company I worked at. They went from 10 staff to 4 staff during winter one. Winter two, when I was there, there was 15 of us, so we just didn't hire any more new people for a period of time. Like engineers come and go, obviously, but no other sort of core operational stuff. And then, yeah, it was sort of, it was definitely, it really kicked off during COVID. Like March, April is when things just went bananas. And then we had the NFT boom.
Oh, yeah, the NFTs. And yeah, it's been interesting to watch. But like, yeah, like when, like that first, like when you're like, I don't know, it was like 20, like Bitcoin was at like a lull for a while, like $500 for a long time, for years. And that's when I used like, oh, it's safe. Like I'll just use Overstock to buy a couch. Like the Bitcoin's not moving. Like it's fine. It's like $1,000 per couch, whatever it is. $2,000 was. And yeah, it was a big mistake. But yeah, and I also like in 2014, I was also mining Litecoin. Like I was like doing it. I tried everything like in the space, like did ICOs in 2017. Didn't make any myself, just I was partaking, but I used to mine. And yeah, it's, I try to follow the evolution of the space. And now like with the NFTs and DeFi, just the newest evolution of this, of crypto.
When you were going through those winter periods, what were you doing? Were you the type of guy who would dollar cost average into things like Ethereum and just investigate what else was going on? How were you looking at this space during these lull periods? Because this is where like I look at so many people who've gotten into this space, and like Gen Z types in particular who are really young, and they're like, they're going through this boom, and we know that there could be a period of time where there's a lull again. So yeah. I look at that and I go, I'm just going to dollar cost average everything that I'm in already, the projects that I really believe in. I'm curious for you, how did you view 2018?
So well before that, and this is like something, my advice I still get to this day to all my friends that like, you know, like Bitcoin is too expensive, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, but like, it's, look at the trajectory it's gone on for the past few years. Like if you truly believe in the space, just set a weekly buy. It doesn't matter how much it is. It could be $1, it could be $100, it could be $1,000, whatever your budget permits, like that you can allow, like you allow, if you have conviction, that's what you can afford to, the same way you'd like, even if it's like this, what you would have spent on coffee that week, just throw it into Bitcoin or Ethereum or any product, like any coin that you believe in, and you'll dollar cost average pretty well. It'll work out for you and you'll build the nest egg over time. Like you don't need to like buy, like for some, like it's, I think people are over it finally. But for years, people had this like mental block where like, I need to own one Bitcoin. I need to own a full Bitcoin. I can't own a portion of it. Like, I don't know what the mental block is with that, but now like, I think people are accepting the fact that fractional coins are okay. Like they don't need to own a full one.
Yeah, that's a good point. So there's an interesting point you made on Twitter the other day. And it was around stablecoins being anchored to the dollar. Basically, the statement was around US being well-positioned to be the crypto leader. And I, to be honest with you, being involved in crypto projects, I would 100% agree with that. Like there's just a fact that the leaders in terms of developers, marketing, partnerships, you know, the project I'm involved in, there is so many people just based on the West Coast in America, Seattle, Bay Area, LA, et cetera. What, how do you view that? Are there things that you're concerned about maybe government policy in particular dampening on that? Or do you think that it's sort of a given just by the nature of the way that the US is and how innovation just comes about in an economy like the US?
I mean, I hope that's what comes down. I mean, there's been a lot of like random talk, and I've seen like the videos like of people in Congress like talking in the Senate talking about crypto and how that it's like scams and how like the stable coins are like not true stable coins and it's be wary of them. I'm sure certainly some of them like are a little, there's like, I know Terror everyone's worried about always, and like there's some other ones that like people are not the most certain of. But I truly hope that, you know, the U.S. government recognizes that this is the direction that the internet is going in and the world is going in. So the fact that like we have things built on stable coins and things are anchored to the dollar seems like a great opportunity for like people in the United States to be the on the forefront of crypto and not be a blocker for it. And like it doesn't make sense to fight the future and fight innovation. Like I hope that we as a country embrace it and you know, set ourselves up for success in the future, because regulating it and cutting it down and limiting it to people is just getting in the way of like all the citizens here for the future potential.
Do you, when you get involved in projects in this Web3 space, do you particularly notice any other jurisdictions where there's a big Web3 NFT or crypto involvement. Like, as an example, the UK, they've got their licensing, which has been really clear for people to run centralized exchanges and other businesses that maybe dub securities, whereas in the US, it's a bit more vague. Have you noticed any particular areas?
I mean, like DeFi in different areas right now, and even coins in itself, like everything is kind of like a gray area that we're like, everyone's still trying to figure out. That's what I was saying. Like, we have the opportunity to truly be like leaders and embrace this, because like it's still gray and the land is not set yet. Like, it's not settled and like we're still figuring everything out. So it can go either direction. It can be overregulated and deter everyone from it and make it very difficult. So companies don't want to launch in the United States and will launch internationally with having an US presence. But I hope that's not the case, because I don't want companies to have to launch internationally. We're starting a DeFi right now. We're going to launch domestically because, you know, we're here and we're in America and we want to like launch a domestic product. We don't want to be forced out. We want to be able to build and have the country support.
What are you looking at like day to day? We all know things like, you know, you see these reports from like Mary Meeker where she talks about like the state of the internet, and obviously it's Web2 focused. You've got platforms like Nansen, which is fascinating to look at all the different contracts that are pumping, whether it's in the DeFi space or for NFTs. Is this something that you wake up and look at each day outside of crypto Twitter?
I'm gonna say I love my crypto Twitter. No, I mean, I read, like, I subscribe to a bunch of different newsletters. I kind of get a little taste of everything. Like, because that I'm involved in so many random areas, that, like, whether it's, like, for Magic Fund, like, doing the investment side, for Juice, like, in the, like marketing technologies and, like, new, like, what is Meta doing now? And, like, what are CPM prices? Like, what is Meta doing? What restrictions they have? What platforms they're launching? Like, I'm just reading across the board. So there's no true consistent, like, day-to-day when I'm reading. But I subscribe to a bunch of different newsletters, whether it's like interesting stuff like the Hustle on Morning Brew or Inside or Launch. Like, I just try to read everything to see what like the world, like kind of get like a Launch is, I think, like a good example, or Inside's a good idea, like the world at a glance, what's going on.
Yeah.
And then if I see any interesting topics, I kind of just dig deeper on my own.
Who on crypto Twitter are you really reading and following regularly?
I mean, there's a lot of great accounts. As far as the NFT side, like, I have to give credit to my buddy Farouk, because he's the one that got me into NFTs. He's the one that harassed me to do it. So I have to give him credit. And he's got an amazing presence on Twitter, which is actually crazy impressive, because he built like 160,000 person following in like 6 months, which is wild. Obviously, Pomp is doing a great job just bringing awareness to the space and spreading news. I have a full list that I can share. I think you shouldn't throw out like that of people that I follow.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating. I'm obviously getting into this DeFi space recently. Just fascinated by people like Tetranode and Zeus and some of these other types that are really dominant in this space. It's also interesting as well when you buy a project, how for whatever reason the algorithm just starts recommending people.
Oh yeah.
But you also got to follow like Kobe and Banksy and all these shit talkers that exist on Twitter, which is absolutely hilarious. You get some more serious types like Zusu or Suzu, however you want to pronounce his name. Three Arrows Capital was a fascinating guy because he'll do both serious stuff and then post memes, which I quite like.
I agree. I always say that, like, anyone that's maybe listening that doesn't use Twitter, it's by far my favorite platform. Like,
yeah,
from an educational standpoint, for networking, just to, like, literally across the board. Like everyone like says, like, I go to LinkedIn for networking. I'm like, no, don't go to LinkedIn.
Nah,
LinkedIn's a giant spam trap. Like, there's way too much going on. You're just a bunch of noise. You're talking to a bunch of bots spamming you. Go to Twitter, join conversations, do research there. Like, it literally has everything you need there.
Yeah, it's so funny. I used to hate Twitter, man, and I realized what the problem was. I was just following news reporters and political people. And so I went through, like, probably a couple of months ago, I culled every single person related to news and politics and just followed everyone in Web3. And, like, it's so much more positive.
It's much happier feed. Yeah.
It's so much happier.
Your overall sentiment of Web3 is just positivity. That's why it's drawing to people in. It's very welcoming.
Yeah, it's super welcoming. They just want others to learn and to get involved, which is what I love.
Exactly.
In terms of your own investing at the moment, do you, outside of your business and maybe if you have some investment in property, are you very consistent or focused in investing in shares in listed companies? Or do you just go, look, I've got the venture fund, I've got everything I've got going on in crypto NFT land, maybe I've got a house, that's all I'm going to focus on? Or do you make it a point that you still invest in shares of companies?
I still invest in shares of companies for sure. I try to diversify as much as possible. And which it's hard because like my investment thesis for my whole life has always been stick to what you know. And what I know is tech. And so like when I invest in like equities, like into like in the stock market, like I'm trying to also diversify outside of what I know, which is tough. And like, because like if I just invest in tech, I have to like, I have like a sector risk, like when tech starts to go poorly. So I try to diversify a bit, like waste management, like boring companies like that I wouldn't really typically know anything about, but I know they're safe long-term. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've always operated under like, the try to diversify as much as possible principle. Just like for a while I was investing in gold. Like I was like, I figured I could invest in Bitcoin and gold, like digital gold and the real gold, invest in stocks, like ETFs, like, and just, yeah, just diversify as much as possible. So no matter what happens, like if there's a crash of some sort, like at least I'm stable in a different area.
Who's that original gold bug that's always calling the crash of Bitcoin? What's his name again?
I forget his name. Is that the guy that called out like the housing crash, like 2008 as well?
Yeah, that's the problem with being a doomer, right? Is like, you get one right.
Like he calls a crash like every year. And like, if you call it enough, it's like, you know, a broken clock's right like twice a year.
Like, he's debated a bunch of people about Bitcoin and just every single time, like he's been wrong. I don't know. I remember back in the day when I first started getting into the way that I found crypto wasn't just a conversation with a friend at uni, it was actually Zero Hedge. So I was like sort of in that doomer sphere of like people always calling for a crash, but there's only so many times you can call it. And then you start to go like, is this boy cried wolf type thing? Like, do these people actually know what they're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I still have friends to this day. It's like crypto crash. It says there's no underlying value, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, I gave up trying to convince my friends and other people. I'm like, you guys know what I'm buying. You know what I'm interested in. If you're interested to learn, I'm happy to tell you. I'm not here to convince you how to spend your money.
Yeah.
But like, there's definitely people constantly that tell me it's like, you're wasting your money. Like, sell Bitcoin while you can. I'm like, okay, like, this is my problem, not yours. Don't worry about it.
All right. Let's jump into some rapid fire questions. What have you been watching recently? Podcast, doco, or movie that you'd recommend to the audience?
I just started listening to, I always listen to How I Built This, my favorite podcast. But I started listening to My First Million, which is a pretty good podcast. I'm weird. Like I hate like silence, but I always like put on background noise for TV. So I just started rewatching 30 Rock, which is just one of my favorite shows.
Okay. 30 Rock. Not bad. I've never actually watched it.
It's a good show. I recommend it.
Yeah. Last question for you. If you could recommend, well, rather if you had $200 that you've spent over the last year or so, what would be the best purchase you've made for $200 or less?
I do so many random purchases, like of random things on Amazon. Like I buy like random gadgets and things. Like, I don't know, like I just like bought this thing, like a little, like this little guy made of like, I don't even know what he's like, screws and stuff. Like, so that's a horrible question for me because I just buy so many random things. Just bought like a Quest 2. Been loving that. But yeah, I mean, it's a hard question. Like,
how much is a Quest these days?
I think it's 180 for the lower model.
Okay. Is there anything in particular you're planning on playing on Quest?
No, I love the VR space. Like, I think like, obviously it's going to just keep developing. Like I always been a Mac user, so I couldn't use like, get like a proper setup for VR. So I'm excited for these like standalone VR products. So like I had the Quest 1, now the Quest 2, like I'll keep buying them because I love the space. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah,
and like, right. Not only for like entertaining myself, but like with an education, I think it's going to completely change education as well. So I'm excited for that space. Not something I've been active in as like an investor or as a builder, but just like as a fan from the sidelines.
Okay. I like it. Yeah. I've been going deep on like Decentraland and portals and all that sort of stuff. So my next
I don't really land in the metaverse, but I do own Mana, which I like.
Okay. Sandbox is another interesting one as well. I still don't know how these things make money. I sort of like particularly the metaverse stuff, like the supply and demand of buying land assets, I'm still so uneasy about. But we'll see. I could be wrong. Troy, thank you, mate, for doing this. I know it's late where you are, but I don't know if you've had dinner. If not, have a lovely dinner and relaxed evening. And thanks for coming on the show. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Twitter's my favorite. My Twitter's pretty easy, just at yo, Y-O. If Instagram's your thing, just my first name, at Troy, on Instagram. And yeah, if you want to get in contact with Juice, that's thinkjuice.com.
Beautiful. Troy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe and of course like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.